Captain Buxton, Reel 3. Apart from the fact that there were aspects of life which were pleasant due to the comradeship and when weather smiled upon you and things like that, it was very much done, in a practical sense, to make the trenches more comfortable for infantry soldiers who had to live in them.
Undoubtedly this was so, as slowly equipment came from places like Norway and Sweden. We hadn't the timber to start with to make decent dugouts. And it was certainly interesting when we captured German ones, what wonderful dugouts they had from the timber which they got from the great forests. And these things were a very real progress in trench health and trench comfort. I think another thing that doesn't appear at once is that I believe I'm right in saying we didn't have really dentists in any number till 1916. And when the dentists came over and the men got their teeth right, they certainly got into another era of health, because their food was properly digested and so on. It's a little thing that, in a sense, as a company commander, I can't say much about, except that there was obviously something of tremendous value that happened when these dentists came and improved teeth and pulled out dead teeth and so on.
Why do you single dental health for special comment?
Because I think, from my memory, right or wrong, it was something that had been overlooked. I don't think the public, for instance, were as conscious of the value of teeth. And I believe it began a tremendous change in the attitude of the working classes and those with less money to look after their teeth after the war. Quite new to what happened before the war.
I wondered if it followed from what you said that dental ill health, as it were, had been a feature during the first part of the war.
I don't think I could say that from any knowledge. I can only say the positive influence when it began to happen that our men went and had their teeth put right and could handle bully and biscuits and better food when we got it.
Apart from these major improvements in the trench constructions as the war progressed, which were made possible by availability of timber and things like that, did the troops themselves, did you yourself, improvise in any way to improve your comfort actually in the trenches?
Well, I think in the Yorkshire Battalion we were very fortunate because we had a lot of miners, and they were very, very strong in handling a shovel. And I think they did do a great deal that some battalions would have found difficult to do because they hadn't got that special background to their work. And I don't remember really an answer to that. We certainly noticed the difference between units we took over from who left us with clean trenches and carefully prepared. They saved casualties, they showed good discipline, and so on, and that's a real thing.
Were there any other aspects, or were there any aspects of life during this early period of the war, in the second half of 1915, that you particularly enjoyed, or that particularly amused you?
I think one of the things that was the difference between the squabbles in industry in peacetime and the enormous fellowship in the discomforts and dangers of war was the conversations one had when on duty, particularly at night. You would get up against the sentry and be talking with him while he was watching, and it was dark and you were alone, and he would open up with his problems at home. It gave a tremendous sense, at any rate to a very young officer like me, of the humanity, shall I say, of the men one commanded, and a very real affection, personal affection for the man you were talking to as you heard about his problems at home. And that is something that, as far as I know, doesn't and probably couldn't take place in industry.
Yeah.
And was one of the reasons why trench warfare made it particularly possible, because you were huddled up together.
Continuing on this line, I wonder whether, for someone from your background and with your education, this in fact brought you into contact with a great variety of people who you otherwise wouldn't have known too well.
Indeed, on some of the home problems, I was entirely and absolutely ignorant, and I would slip around that evening to the colonel and say, "What do I say to this?" Because he was a head of a business and he understood the moral situations in homes, and I was only a boy, as it were. And therefore one learnt a lot of human life and human nature, which was healthy for one to have to face and try to help in.
Could you see from your own experiences any process of sort of social leavening which was brought on by this kind of close relations that you inevitably developed with your men in the trenches?
I think that's a very good question. And I think perhaps I was very lucky on that, for my father himself, but my grandfather also, who had a large farm, was a way ahead of his time in really going to town, in giving his employees good cottages and caring for them when they were sick, long before there was any thought of medical health. And therefore I had been brought up to have concern and I don't know what word to use, partnership, fellowship, with people who were doing other things of a different nature, what we call now the working class. And I had seen my grandmother go round in the carriage, and she'd call in on a cottage and leave fruit and things, because she had a child who was ill. And, you know, my little boy heart was influenced by it. Mm. And I think it therefore was not a great change to me. It was merely learning to put into practice in this setting what I had seen my grandparents do in their setting and my parents in his setting.
Turning to a little more frivolous point, I believe that even the rats, unpleasant creatures though they were a source of some fun to you.
Yes, I remember very well sentries putting, fixing bayonets and putting a bit of cheese on the end of the bayonet and then shooting the rats. But they were awful. They were so fast. They would, evidently there was something in the sandbag material that they fed on. I don't know what it was, but they just shuddered me. I don't think there was any cure for them. There were such hundreds of them.
Now, out of the front line, when you were in the rear areas, you presumably had some opportunities to go into the towns and to perhaps have rather different kind of food than you were accustomed to in military life. Can you remember any particular...
Yes,
places that,
I do remember when we were further down on the Somme, when we were up at Ypres, we would go to Popperinge, where later I went on a stretcher. But on the Somme, we went into Amiens, and there was a restaurant there right under Shellfire, run by a man called Mr. Gobert and his four daughters. And on the Somme, we were very much bully and biscuits, and we would go and have duck and green peas there. We, in that war, of course, company commanders had a horse. We'd ride in to Amiens when we were in reserve and have a jolly good supper and come back terribly pleased.
I suppose it would give you the opportunity to forget about the war for a while.
Absolutely. Even though shelling was taking place in a rather lackadaisical affair, I've always wondered whether that family lived or whether they were eventually hit. I don't know what happened.
I think this restaurant was not in Amiens, was it?
No, Armentières.
Ah, good. Okay.
It may interest you that it was east of Armentières, that Dr. Chavasse, the son of the Bishop of Liverpool and brother of the Bishop of Rochester later, got his VC and bar, and got a VC, two DSOs or three DSOs and MC, an amazing doctor.
Now, you'd gone out to France in April of 1915, and then in August you were wounded and hospitalized. How were you wounded?
I wasn't actually wounded, I put my knee out.
Oh, I see.
In the trench, and had to be taken down. And was taken down to Wimereux, where the Duchess of Westminster had the casino.
I see.
As a hospital.
Yes. Now, after a short period in hospital in France, you were invalided home to England. Tell me which hospital you went to in England and what the conditions there were like. Now, you had some experience of hospitals in England, both from this occasion and also later on when you were wounded. Were the hospitals that you were moved into regular military hospitals?
I was very lucky. First of all, when I did my knee, I went into the Duchess of Westminster's hospital in Wimereux, which was wonderfully staffed, and because of her generosity, the food was good. One of the nurses had a beautiful voice and used to sing from the galleries before she went off duty. And then I came over when I was wounded to Lady Wavertree's hospital, which was her own house in Regent's Park, Sussex Lodge, and was entirely for very severely wounded people. All the staff were professionals from Guy's Hospital, and the two doctors, two brothers, were top Guy's surgeons.
I believe not all of the hospitals you attended were regular hospitals staffed by full-time professionals. Wasn't there some element of a voluntary effort?
Yes. Lady Wavertree's was all professionals except her niece, who was a VAD. In one of the other hospitals, there were some very fine VADs who had come from homes where they had had certain simple training, and they did a lot of the donkey work. You see,
now during the winter of 1516, you went to Mansfield and served for a while with the 6th Reserve Battalion. In the training of recruits, which is the work you were involved in, I wonder if the lessons, if any lessons of the war so far, had been learned and were actually being applied in the training that was given to the recruits in England at this time.
That was certainly so, because they were able to collect wounded officers, wounded NCOs and men who could in the training share their experience. And they had already begun courses on certain things. I remember being sent on a course showing how to build, say, your dugout in such a way that the Germans couldn't see, or how to construct a point from which a rifle could fire without the Germans seeing the flash. Now, things like that, experienced people from the front were back now wounded and could train.
Yeah. Exactly how were those things achieved? I mean, take for example sighting dugouts.
Well, it was learning how to look at the land. As you look out on the lawn here, there don't appear to be folds, but when you actually crawl over it, you could probably find there were places where you were pretty well hidden. And it was learning to see folds in the ground and learning to see points from which you could see the enemy trenches.
Now, when you were at Mansfield training new recruits, you must have been able to make a comparison with the quality of recruits that were coming into the army in the winter of 1915-16 as compared with the first volunteers. Did you draw any conclusions on that score?
I don't think I could say that I did. Of course, the first volunteering was very much the cream. And one of the tragedies of it was that so many very valuable people were lost who should have been preserved for leadership as NCOs or officers.
Yes. So no particular impressions of the recruits that
not
you were
that
training?
I remember, no.
Let's go back to the actual process of training the recruits. Were there any other training activities apart from the ones you've mentioned that you carried out? The throwing bombs was something which you suggested was newly introduced into the training procedure.
Yes, and of course a lot of games to get them fit and to get them all that a game teaches. They were now beginning, you see, courses on the use of machine guns, how to set them for the best use of the ground and so on, all those kind of things. Time was making it possible to have specialized training.
Yes.
That's my chief memory.
What about infantry advancing with fixed bayonets? Was that still a part of the training procedure?
Yes, certainly. We used to put our bayonets into sandbags instead of into people and